Okay. All right, everyone. We're all here. My name is Ernest Priestley, and I'm the founder of Moms Fighting Autism. I want to welcome you to our fourth conference call. We've had several calls here before in the month of August, and this is our first one in September. And we've covered topics relating to IEPs, topics relating to different therapies, and we've covered topics, you know, related to different types of behavioral issues. And now we're going to talk about the role of diet with autism. And today we are really, really lucky to have Betsy Hicks, who is the co-founder of the Pathway Medical and Holistic Center in Wisconsin. She's an author, a radio host, a video anchor, and she serves as Pathway's diet counselor, public education coordinator, and oversees the practices of the day-to-day operations of the company. She is also a mother to a son with autism, so she has a lot of experience to share with us, and she also speaks nationally on holistic interventions for children with disabilities. Betsy specializes in overcoming picky eating, which is a problem for me when I was growing up, and finding creative and practical techniques for inspiring children and adults to enjoy a variety of foods. So we all want to welcome Betsy Hicks. Betsy, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
Thank you, Ernest. I'm very honored to be here and excited to be here. This is very exciting, especially as I heard some of the questions coming in. We have people calling in from Iraq and all over the world. And I, for the person calling in Iraq, I did look up to see what time it is. It's 4 o'clock in the morning there. So
how about
this is a great way to start your day. And I guess there will be some transcripts available for this too, Ernest?
Oh, yes. Yes, all the transcripts as well as the audio so that people can play them in their cars. You know, they can download the audio for it and make a CD to play in their cars if they so choose.
Well, that's exciting.
As well as the transcripts.
Wonderful. Okay. All right. Well, should I just begin at this point now? Are you ready for me?
Sure. You know, tell us a little bit about diet, you know, because I know there's a lot of, you know, questions. There's a lot of people have very curious about gluten. Free diets as well as casein-free diets, and I'm sure people want to know kind of your experience, what you went through with your son.
Why don't I give you a little bit of a background as to where I'm coming from. And just so you know, it is actually on the website, it is, or on your website, casein is spelled incorrectly. So anybody who's looking at this, it is C-A-S-E-I-N, but that's okay.
Yes.
I just want to make sure people know that that was just a misprint of some sort. Anyway, my background is very, very long in this area because you don't meet many people these days who've been doing this for longer than a decade. My son was one of the earlier children that was part of this vast amount of autism that we see today. And I'm going back now 11 years. He's 15 years old now, and so he was 4 when I first learned of this diet, and this was very little was done. Lisa Lewis was just getting together with her book. Dan was just beginning. The Dan conferences for Defeat Autism Now were just beginning. And I went to my first Dan conference, and actually at that particular conference, that's where I started really getting into this a little bit more. But when I first started learning about this, there was no information. The only products we had out there were rice milk and rice cakes. That was about all there was to purchase. And I was married to my ex-husband at the time, and things were very difficult. Let me tell you a little bit about my son, because I want people to understand that I've walked the walk. Now, this is one thing to have a child that, you know, is cooperating, is totally understands this. But my son truly, and after over 14 years really working in the autism field, I can honestly tell you that he was the most severe that I've ever seen in my life. Extremely self-abusive, highly medicated to keep himself from killing himself, very, very severe situation, and really in a desperate mode, but there weren't a lot of answers. So I learned of this diet when he was 4 and saw an amazing difference in him right away. But there was a lot of roads to pay for him, and my son is doing amazingly well now. But I know that the diet was the most important foundation. One of the things that I'm really going to stress for the parents today, because I got a lot of questions, Ernest, on the subject of – is this for Asperger's? Is this for ADD? Is this for autism? And I really, really want you all to hear this loud and clear, is that this is for anyone on the spectrum and then some. And there's a very, very good chance that if you have children, especially more than one child on the spectrum, there's a good chance that one of the parents is on the spectrum. Now, I don't want to scare anybody, because this is not a bad thing. I'm the first person to admit that I have ADHD, and it's probably carried me through the years in a very positive way in some aspects. So I'm not embarrassed to say that. But in other words, this diet could be especially good for one of the parents as well, too. And we'll talk about those early signs that you can look for, as well as signs that you may have been experiencing your whole life.
Mm-hmm.
So my story continues with I started support groups, and then I eventually started helping a lot of doctors out. And I went to my first DAN conference and met an amazing pediatrician there who was searching for answers, trying to figure out why all these children that were in his practice had autism. And when I got back to my home where I lived in Chicago, he asked me to work as a diet counselor in his office, of which I agreed to. And I worked there for about a year, went back to the same conference, this time sat next to him on the plane and fell in love with him.
Wow.
And my husband, Dr. John Hicks, and I married shortly after. He's the most amazing man in the world. And
you just had an anniversary on Thursday, I think, correct?
I did. We just had an anniversary, and we've been together actually for about 6 years now, 6.5 years. And when we first got together, we immediately wanted to start a clinic for autism, but we wanted it to be very holistically based. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on that now. You don't need to hear all
sure.
the history for that. But my my website is pathwaysmed.com, pathwaysmed.com, if you'd like to learn more about that, because I really want to get on with all of these amazingly wonderful questions and help people
sure.
understand this. Now, one of the first things that I feel is important for all of you to understand is how important diet matters. I have seen autism change over the last decade tremendously. It's gone from, please, does anybody have any ideas, to, we've got an idea, but it's going to cost you $10,000. And it's gotten to a really big money-making type of an industry. And there's a lot of gimmicks out there. There's some really good things, but there's a lot of gimmicks out there. And it's very hard for parents to really differentiate and know which direction to go to. But there's one area that you just can't have any discrepancy for, and that is diet. I mean, this is what goes in the body every single day. And, you know, it amazes me, just really amazes me when I see, and I'm not a big pro chelation person in the form of DMSA and EDTA and those types of things, because I'm holistically based, but it amazes me the people that are doing that, but then giving their child Skittles every day. And it's like, well, if you're taking toxins out, wouldn't it make sense to not put any more in? And so when we talk about diet, we have to think about this. This is the potential of toxicity, or the potential of cleaning up the system that you have every single day. And there's nobody who understands more picky eating than I do, because I was faced with my son, who truly for a year of his life only ate cereal. And he ate Barbara's Brown Rice Crisp cereals with rice milk. As soon as I started him on this diet, he ate that for a full year, and that was the only thing I could get down him. So I understand picky eating. I understand where it stems from. I understand what severity of this. I've counseled thousands of people, and we're going to really hit on that picky eating issue today too. But first, let's understand, what is this gluten and casein-free diet? Now, the other thing I want to start off by saying, too, is that there's no one-size solution for every family. This is not what worked for your neighbor or your niece or your nephew is going to work for you, because gluten and casein is a beginning, but it's only a beginning to really looking at the whole diet. Because my take on all of this diet is that we can't just call this a gluten and casein-free diet. We have to call this a nutritious gluten and casein-free diet, because it's about the whole thing of what everyone's eating. And I really today want to teach you to have a positive focus on this, because it's scary and it seems overwhelming to so many people. But 95% of the parents that I work with say that just every month it gets easier and easier because of the fact that it just becomes what it is. And you really, just like if somebody told you that every single day you had to give your child a medication and you had to get it down them 3 times a day, you would make sure that that child got that medication. And we're going to say,
right.
I'm saying the same thing holds true with diets.
Right.
So let's start with this whole, what is the reason for doing a gluten and casein-free diet? Now, there is this enzyme in everybody's body. It's called dipeptidyl peptidase 4. You don't need to know that, but it's also referred to as DPP4. And this particular enzyme is responsible for breaking down certain proteins. Now, gluten is a protein, and casein is a protein. And DPP4 is the main enzyme that's supposed to break down these proteins. Now, the protein comes through in this large chain amino acid. It's quite long, and typically your enzymes are supposed to break it apart and make it very assimilated through your body, and so you can use it and take the protein out of it and create amino acids through it in your body, and that's what it's supposed to do. But for whatever particular reason you may want to know of, it's either missing or blocked in many different people. Now, I'm believing more and more that it's blocked than it's missing, because I'm seeing more and more families be able to reintroduce gluten and casein into the diet once the gut is really, really healed. So I don't hold to the fact that this is necessarily something that is for a lifetime. And that's an exciting thing, and that's a new piece. If you had heard me speak a year ago, I would not have said that. But I've seen enough testimony to it now that I do believe it. But here's the thing with it. If you eliminate gluten and casein, that doesn't fix anything. You have to heal the gut as a whole, and there's many different ways of doing that I won't get into today, and we can always discuss that at a further time. But healing the gut, fixing the immune system, clearing the detox, all of those are really essential to making more foods come back in the diet. Now, what is gluten? Well, gluten is in many different forms, and since we have people from so many different countries, I'm going to list a lot of different forms of gluten that may not be too big in this country, but might be big in your country. So, of course, you have the wheat and the barley and the rye that you hear so much of. Oats is a very controversial one, because oats themselves, right off out of the field, do not have gluten. But the way they're processed in the United States, the gluten actually gets back into the oats. So that is why you want to specifically look for gluten-free oats. But this is a very new and exciting thing for us, that we've got oats back in our diet, because it's only been in the last 2 years that they've been able to release gluten-free oats for us, and it's a wonderful food. Then you have things like bulgur and couscous and spelt and semolina. Durum wheat is also big, and farro and gram and kamut. Matzo meal and triticale is also considered gluten. I'm sorry if I went too quick on that. The spelt is probably, and kamut are the two of the ones that you're going to see in American grocery stores as much besides the wheat and the barley and the rye. Spelt and kamut are wheat. They are just a heirloom version of wheat. So they're wheat before it was genetically modified. Much more digestible, much more healthy, but still have gluten. So it's important to know that. So what are gluten-free flours and starches? Well, there's many of them, and the one that you see the most of is always in the form of rice, white rice, brown rice, wild rice, black and sweet rice, lots of different rices that are out there, but that's the most common that's used in gluten-free foods. The other one that's also very common used in gluten-free foods is corn. But the problem with rice is that you can't necessarily substitute it for wheat flour. Why? Because gluten has elasticity. So when you have a flour that doesn't have gluten in it, you lose elasticity. So what manufacturers do is they have to put in certain types of grains that, or excuse me, starches that actually will help add softness to the bread. A lot of these starches are very heat sensitive. In other words, that is why gluten-free breads usually taste so much better if they're warmed a little bit, because the warming will make them more elastic. And those types of starches are things like arrowroot, potato starch, tapioca. Those are all usually in just about any type of a recipe to help give it softness. There are other grains, of course, that are out there that are wonderful. Amaranth is a wonderful high-protein grain. Actually, it's an herb, but that's another wonderful one. Bean flours are getting more and more attention. Pinto and garfava, garbanzo and lentil flours. I'm a huge fan of Indian cuisine, and the urad or urad flours, which are made of lentil flours, are fantastic. You can get things like papadums, which are a wonderful lentil flour cracker that in Indian grocery stores. Buckwheat is gluten-free. Millet is also well-known. A lot of people ask me about things that the millet breads through DeLand Bakery and Sammy's Bakery that make millet breads. Sammy's is definitely not 100% gluten-free, and I do not know the latest on DeLand. DeLand has gone from having gluten to not having gluten to having gluten to not having gluten, so I'm not even sure where they stand anymore. Montina flour is another good one, very high protein. There's nut flours, things like almond flour and hazelnut flour that are wonderful because they add fiber and protein to your foods as well. There's things like pea flour, which also add protein. Quinoa is another great one. Quinoa is spelled Q-U-I-N-O-A. The first actual grain that was in the United States, even before corn, it is much more going back history-wise to the Indians eating large amounts of quinoa. Very high protein. You find it in almost all vegetarian-type restaurants. Sorghum is another gluten-free flour. Sorghum is a very close cousin of corn. We're going to be talking a lot about corn in a little bit and some of the concerns with corn, but please remember that sorghum is a close cousin of corn, so if your child has a sensitivity to corn, sorghum may be a problem as well. I am not a fan of soy. We'll talk about that a little bit, but it is a gluten-free flour. And teff is a great one. Teff is found mostly in parts of Africa. And T-E-F-F. And teff is got almost like a little bit of a chocolatey taste to it, so it does really well. In parts of Africa, they make something called injera, which is a flat bread. Of course, in Africa, they make it one from 100% teff. In the United States, most African restaurants combine it with wheat flour, so be very, very careful if you see teff bread in the United States that they did not add wheat to it, because teff alone can be a little strong. Casein is the protein that's found in dairy. It's from cow, sheep, goat. Nowadays, you can even find buffalo yogurt, and it's also from buffalo. It's basically any animal's milk, and that is although goat milk and sheep milk may be a lot more digestible, it still has high concentrations of casein. Mother's milk is fine, but you cannot do any type of an animal milk. Now, the casein-free options seem to grow more and more with every particular year. And this is interesting, Ernest. One of the main questions I got from some of the ones that you sent me were regarding cheese, people begging me for good cheese substitutes. And I have to say that I'm not as up on it as, because there's been a few new ones that have been coming out recently, but my favorite types of cheese substitutes are made from nuts. They have a lot of the raw restaurants that are out there, raw cuisine cookbooks, make a lot of nut-type casein-free cheeses. They're soft, usually more like a ricotta. But there are some rice cheeses that are out there right now that are pretty decent. I am not a fan of soy. Once again, we'll talk about that a little bit later, but I think those are some of the best. One of my favorite ways of having, you have rice milk, there's almond milk, hazelnut milk, hemp milk is wonderful. Those are all very good milks. Coconut milk is great. here is my kind of rule of thumb. Coconut milk really belongs only in recipes that are Asian, Indian, anything Eastern type, more for that type of cuisine. It does well in some South American cuisines, but coconut milk does not do well in European type foods. You know, you wouldn't put coconut milk in your risotto, your Italian risotto type of thing. So keep that for that. However, I am a huge fan of making my own nut milk. It's very, very simple to do, and the taste is amazing because there are some times that I want something thick. I want a thick, creamy type milk, and by making them myself, I can control how watery they are or how thick they are. And they only last about a week, so it's something that you know need to do in small batches. But all you really need is a very, very powerful blender, just a good, strong blender. For example, what I do when I make mine is I put 1 cup of raw, important that they're raw, cashews, but you could use raw any nut or seed, actually, and 2 cups of very hot water. And put those in the blender for about 2 minutes until it's exceptionally smooth. And you can use that milk as a wonderful pudding maker. It'll really cream up a lot of different things. Cashews make a wonderful creaming type of foods.
I've made milk like that, actually.
Yeah, it's not very hard to do, but it's very important that you get raw. And save yourself some money.
Right.
Buy the pieces, not the whole cashews, because pieces are a lot cheaper. Okay, so what is it about this diet? We've talked about this kind of opioid effect, but what is really happening? So when this whole chain amino acid crosses the blood-brain barrier, it has a very similar amino acid makeup of that of morphine. It's called the opioid effect. And what happens is it reacts, it kind of turns on the opioid receptors. And so many people say, well what should I be looking for? What should I be looking for in, if they have the problem? And what should I be looking for in getting improved? So there are many different symptoms because it's very similar to if we have over 1,000 people listening today. If I gave any of you a shot of morphine, you would probably all react very, very differently. Some would make very sleepy. Some would make very hyper. Some might make angry. Some may make them kind of just out of it and kind of spacey. So it's how does this receptor, when it's turned on in your own specific brain, react for your child or yourself or your other children? So some of the symptoms to look at, one of the big ones is hyperactivity. And this is something you can really test. I remember watching some of my husband's patients and when they come for their first appointment and the kids get in there and they're really, really wild. And then mom just needs to get them quiet for a while, so she hands them a bag of Goldfish crackers or some Oreo cookies. And the kids eat those almost as if they're, not almost, they are eating them in an addictive type format. You can just see the comfort that they're actually getting from eating it. And for those 10 minutes, they're usually exceptionally quiet because they're getting their fix. But then about 20 minutes later, sometimes 15 minutes, sometimes even less, the hyperactivity and the screaming and the anxiety begins. Moodiness is another big one. In other words, kind of that bipolar hot and cold piece. Spaced out, just kind of really out there and not able to, you know, you're calling their name, Joey, 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 and they're just not responding. Poor memory is another big one. Sleep problems are huge. That's one of the neatest things that parents tell me, that when their child started the diet, they started sleeping through the night for the first time. Poor organizational skills is another big symptom. Inability to multitask, never feeling full is another one. We had a question Ernest asked of us today about a couple children that they never get enough food. And you have to think about it. If you're very addicted to something, no matter feeling full or not, you're going to keep eating. You're going to keep eating because it's feeding that addiction. So that is a really big one. Urine and stool control is another huge one that people tell me that they get their kids potty trained for the first time after starting the diet.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the biggest ones I would say, though, more than any of these combined, is the second to the last is crave only gluten and casein, and the last is an extreme picky eater. Rarely, rarely, rarely does a parent ever say to me, my child eats just about anything, and so do you think this diet, you know, and then we would actually see some big benefits from doing the diet. It is usually specifically only the kids that are picky eaters, and it's so funny because so many parents will say to me, you know, we certainly, Ernest, got a lot of questions about this. My child only eats five foods. You know, they only eat Goldfish crackers or chocolate milk or Nutri-Grain bars is always a big one for some reason. Pizza, macaroni and cheese. And they say to me, you know, if I stop those five foods, my child will starve. And I don't mean to be cruel in my response, but my response is always, your child already is starving. If those are the only foods that they're getting, you're giving them calories. So you're keeping them alive through calories, but nutritionally they're starving. So you have no place to go but up from here. And we're going to talk about this picky eating issue. I don't even know if I've told you this, Ernest, but I'm writing a book on picky eating. And
wow.
I have been teaching this and specializing in this for a lot of years, and right now I'm just in search of a publisher, but I'm hoping to have this together soon because I have a lot of different formats that work really well in getting to picky eating, and we'll spend as much time as we can on that subject today. So now that's the foundation for the gluten, the casein piece of this, but here's a big, big message today that we can't spend a lot of time on today, but if any of this is something that you want to hear more about, go back to the website for comments and let them know that you'd like to hear me give a lecture more on this, and I'd be happy to return and give different lectures on different subjects. The other thing, too, I'd like you all to know, I've been doing a radio show for Autism One and Voice America for 3 years, and I have archives like crazy on all of these subjects, and you can listen to past radio shows on my website, which is pathwaysmed.com, and you can go to the section Learn, and then go to Podcast, and you can pull up my archives on a lot of them. I just stopped doing the show so that I could finish my book on picky eating and have more time. So
repeat that again one more time so people can...
Sure, it's pathwaysmed.com. Go to the section Learn, and then go under Podcast. Now, if I could say one thing, too, because I know my email address is on my website, I am currently running our medical practice, raising three children, trying to fight through an IEP process right now, and traveling the country, doing a lot of speaking engagements. So I really dislike not answering somebody in an email, but sure. I will probably not have a lot of time to spend on an email response. I do appointments. I don't have a lot of appointments available because I'm spending more time running the business, but I do have quite a few diet counselors that work for me, and my husband does accept new patients as well, but I do accept new patients for diet counseling as well. I will only see patients, though, that also are part of the whole clinic because I am not a fan of just addressing the diet and not addressing the whole issue. So just wanted to tell you that. But, yes, my email address is on the website, and I will do my best to answer you. And if you'd like to send us just a quick email, we will put you on our newsletter list and let you know when things are progressing through the office as well.
Fantastic.
So going back to more pieces on the diet – doing gluten and casein free may not be enough, just doing that alone. And I know that comes as a freak out type of a response today because you're just barely even possibly some of you coping with the thought of even doing gluten and casein. But here's why I feel so compelled to tell you this. It's because I hear so many people say they did the gluten and casein free diet and it didn't work. And I don't believe that it's the gluten and casein free diet that didn't work. I just don't believe the big picture was looked at enough. As an example, my son still has a very severe reaction to corn. What's the first thing you increase when you go on a gluten free diet? You increase corn because so many of the products out there have corn. So
it's in everything.
Right. So initially when I made him gluten-free, I saw no improvement at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was because I wasn't looking at the whole big picture. So I want to mention a couple things today just to put a bug in your ear about it, just so that you feel like you get a little better of the whole picture. And one of that is digestive enzymes. And we did have a couple questions about digestive enzymes, and I'm a big fan of them. I am not a fan of them to replace the diet. I don't believe you can take enough DPP-4 to be able to replace having to do a gluten casein-free diet. And they have many of the enzyme companies have these replacement-type enzymes, but I believe those are best for a child that is not 100% possibly on the diet, just kind of loosely doing it. Here's the thing with it, and this goes into this whole piece with the whole cheating factor, the question of can they occasionally go off the diet, which is another question we were asked. And I very, very strongly say no. It's got to be 100%. And let me say, it's not so much for the body that it has to be 100%. It's for the person or the child doing this. It's, think of this as like alcoholism. If, when you know somebody that's an alcoholic and they're very, very addicted, if they decide to get off of this addicted product of alcohol, you wouldn't, on their birthday, give them a shot of whiskey to say, well, it's right. Your birthday, so go ahead and have it, because you know what would happen. It would trigger the memory of what that tasted like, how it felt, how that addiction was, and it makes it so much harder on the child if you're occasionally giving it to them. They, aside from the whining factor that will dramatically increase, because if they know you caved in one time, they know you're going to cave in again, and all they have to do is beg for it enough, and you feel guilty. I understand that guilt, because the guilt comes from, I don't want to have to do this, so I certainly don't want to make them have to do this, but on many factors, you know, it is really, really good to do this as a family. So I strongly suggest not taking enzymes just to replace the gluten casein piece of it, but I do highly recommend enzymes for pancreatic functioning in general. It helps you be able to absorb the food that you're eating. What happens in our kids' systems because of either heavy metal toxicity or whatever the situation is, their pancreases are not working really well. And when they don't work very well, they don't produce the enzymes that help break down the foods. So what happens is they eat the foods, and they really kind of come out the same way they came in. And what's the sad thing is that if you're working so hard to get meat and vegetables down your children, if they're not assimilating them, it's not doing any good. So enzymes are a big key. I'm a big fan of the company Enzymedica. I find them easy to find. They're affordable, and I just like their products. I like the company. I've known the owner for a while. They're a good company, and I've done quite a few radio shows on enzymes. So you're welcome to listen on my podcast. You're welcome to listen to those from my website. But I'd be happy to come back and talk about that more. But another big thing with so many of our kids is the reflux. So what's the first thing that the doctors do when our kids have reflux? They give them an antacid, which is the absolute opposite of what they need. The reason that they have this acidic buildup in their esophagus is because they're not digesting their food. And so what happens is the food just sits there and it rots and it forms an acid reflux, which what the doctors are giving an antacid, which is killing all the hydrochloric acid, making it even more difficult for your child to digest their next meal. It's the absolute opposite of what you should be doing. So if your child's been diagnosed an antacid, please look into enzyme therapy for things such as that. Digest Gold is a great product. I cannot by any means whatsoever recommend any supplements today to you. I am not legally allowed to, nor is that ethically a good thing for me to be able to do. I'm not a medical doctor. I'm not a dietitian that can actually recommend that. So I know a tremendous amount about this because of my husband, but please don't stop any medication. Don't do anything based on my advice today. That's my disclaimer because my best friend's an attorney,
sure.
So I have to give that going on. The other thing that could also be a problem besides the gluten and casein is soy. As I was talking to you earlier, corn is a big one that, you know, is increased, but the other thing that increased frequently is soy. Now, for those of you who may or may not know this, in both France and Israel, they are banning soy formulas, and they are recommending that adults have consumed soy no more than once a week. They're two of the countries that are really on to the dangers of soy. Soy, it's a protease inhibitor, and protease is one of the most important digestive enzymes that we have, in addition to amylase and lipase. Those are very important digestive enzymes, and soy actually blocks the enzymes from functioning, which is where that bloating type feeling comes from. It's also a very high allergen, and it's something that I do not recommend in large amounts of. Now, if your child doesn't appear to have any problems with soy, then a little bit is fine, but I certainly would not go pushing soy ice creams, soy cheeses, soy milks, soy lattes, those types of things. You want to stay away from all of those as best that you can. Soy is also a leading cause of infertility, so all of you moms out there who may be trying to get pregnant again, that's part of the reason that Israel has banned
soy. Now, why is that? Is it because of the estrogen that it creates? Or?
It is. People are already in estrogen overdrive, and I say people because it's not just women. That's why men are getting breast buds and things such as that, and it is not the way to control your estrogen. Soy is not a good remedy for that. And Dr. Kayla Daniel has written a wonderful book that if you'd like to learn more about that, Dr. Kayla Daniel's book is called The Whole Soy Story. It's a great book not only on soy but also on excitotoxins, which are another big concern out there. Now, a lot of times people will say to me, so is my child allergic to gluten and casein? And they could be, but that's not typically what the problem is. Typically, our kids don't have a lot of quote-unquote allergies. Those allergies are called IgE allergies. That's when they test for, the doctors may test for, they're called IgE. It's very important you know the difference between IgE and IgG. IgE are food allergies. IgG are food intolerances. The IgE, the food allergies, are more inherent. They're more things that they don't go away very easily. They're usually due to something that's happened in the immune system, tragically, and they also are frequently inherited. They have a long memory. The IgE are the ones that you see of the kids that have anaphylactic reactions. They also cause extreme rashes and eczema. Typically the common ones are peanuts and tree nuts, fish, shellfish, and things like dairy and eggs, wheat and soy. Those are all typical ones. But the ones that we tend to see more in the children on the spectrum are the IgG food intolerances. Once again, they're not allergies, they're food intolerances, but they're very, very common. And it's important that you note this when you're starting to do any sort of dietary intervention. Now, there's different tests that can be done out there. And I should have mentioned earlier that one of the best tests for testing for gluten and casimorphin and gliadorphin, to test to see if the diet is necessary for yourself or your child, the best one that I feel right now is out there is by Genova. Genova is doing an excellent one. You can go to their website at genova.com. They're looking at all the different markers because there's so many markers to know if gluten or casein is a problem. I'm not a fan of the Great Plains one. They don't do many markers for it, and there's a lot of false readings on it. So if you've been tested before and had a negative through the Great Plains, please, I urge you to do the Genova one. It's a little bit more money, but it's much more comprehensive, giving you a better picture. Now, but there's a lot of different companies that are doing IgG food intolerances. And it's a good thing to do because it's good to know food that you may not consider, may not have thought about, like garlic or eggs is a really, really big one for food intolerances. Now, how do these IgG food intolerances begin? Well, pretty much it's a combination of many things. It starts off with this really unbalanced immune system, which is frequently what happens when we're looking at immune damage due to vaccines. What happens is during the vaccine, because you're getting so many live viruses at one time, the immune system gets stuck in this overdrive, and it's constantly making antibodies to everything, anti-myelin antibodies and all of these different antibodies. It's constantly shooting out. And then what also happens is dysbiosis frequently sets in. Not enough good bacteria in the gut. Yeast start to grow rampant, and we get what's called a leaky gut syndrome. Now, leaky gut is very, very simple, and it is exactly what it is. It's basically yeast kind of puts itself on the walls of the intestines, and food particles leak out into the gut, and that's why they call it leaky gut. But these food particles are not where they're supposed to be. So what is that overactive immune system going to do? It's going to create antibodies. And the overactive immune system creates antibodies to all these different foods, the foods typically that the child's eating the most of, which just about every child is eating the most of, gluten and casein. So it's an additional piece besides the whole peptide piece. This is something that's very, very common in autism and all Asperger's and ADD and such. And it's something that really needs to be addressed, and it does get better. If you treat the leaky gut through many different ways, you can get these to pass. But it's important that you know that this might be a problem. Now, if you don't have access to doing a test or the money to do the test, I totally respect and feel that you don't really need to. You can take away any food for 10 days and reintroduce it and see what happens. Now, you can't do this for gluten and casein. I mean, you can, but you're not going to get a reading because of the fact that the opioid, the peptide effect, those peptides can stay in the system for months. So taking it away for just 10 days and reintroducing it is not going to give you an accurate reading. It could take up to 3 months before you really get a clearing and know better, a good reading on the benefits of gluten and casein. Mm-hmm. So another thing that a lot of you hear out there is you're hearing a lot about celiac disease. And this isn't necessarily exceptionally common with autism as well, too, but it is an autoimmune disease, and it is big out there. And gluten intolerance, which is really, everybody's getting diagnosed with IBS these days, which really is, in most cases, gluten intolerance. But you're hearing more about this. And the reason I mention this is because gluten, in general, is becoming a big thing for a lot of people to give up. Why is this? Because gluten isn't even in recognizable forms anymore. The wheat that we're eating today is nowhere near the wheat that our ancestors have eaten. They have genetically modified it. They've attenuated the cells and made it so that it just does not really even break down or digest. And it's making it a very high allergen because of it. So just wanted to let you know that's another thing, another reason to be giving up gluten. So one of the more common problems, though, that we see is a lot of problems with corn. Now, I don't want to freak you out because if you're just starting to do a gluten casein free diet, the last thing you need me to tell you is that you also have to be corn and soy free. I may not get a chance to talk to you again, so I really just feel that this might be step two or step three, and maybe not till next year. But please note that if you see your child start doing really well from a gluten casein free diet, and then 5 months later they're starting to decline, those are the first two foods I want you to look at is gluten and casein. Or corn and soy. The third one that I want you to look at is eggs. Now, my theory on eggs is that, you know, our vaccines are cultivated on eggs, and that is the first allergen that your immune system is getting attacked with. So I think that's why eggs becomes a problem for a lot of kids. But by all means, if your child's doing well on eggs are one of the most perfect foods when they're organic. and don't eliminate the eggs unless you need to. Corn and soy, on the other hand, have really no good benefit and no need in the diet. Here's my take on corn. I'll make this really quick. If your child has had a comprehensive digestive stool analysis, any sort of a stool analysis that shows that they have bacteria in their gut, Helicobacter pylori, gamma strep, any kind of E. coli, the bad E. coli, which hemolytic E. coli, the Clostridium, Klebsiella, any of these bacteria, one of the things you need to know is that corn and sugar, but corn especially in the form of high fructose corn syrup, feed these bacteria very rapidly. So if you're noticing problems with corn, there's a good chance that the child also has a large amount of bacteria. Now, where I tend to see this the most are the kids that crave corn. They're eating these horrible foods like Gorilla Munch, and I'm sure there's a lot of parents out there that's like, ah, that's the only gluten-free food that they'll eat is Gorilla Munch cereal. You know, but this is corn bacteria feeding food. I'm not saying that you can never do Gorilla Munch, but it should not be your child's main source of food. Parasites are another big one. Now, did we just have a full moon? I can't remember. When was our last full moon, Ernest? Do you know when it was?
I don't remember, but okay. I can Google it here.
Well, it's interesting because parasites are a really neat one because it's very easy to test this one. Parasites are hard to pick up on a stool test because they're cyclable, which means they only surface a few days, really strongly surface to where they'd be detectable in a stool test only a few months out of the year. And so, a few days out of the month. So typically they tend to surface around the full moon. So if you're seeing hyperactivity around the full moon, then parasites are another thing you need to be careful of. The foods typically that are craved when parasites are big in a child are the nightshade vegetables. Potatoes, tomatoes, eggplants, things like that are all really, really big with parasites. Fake food is another big concern of mine that I want to make sure that you're not giving your children. And by fake food, I mean things like Fruity Pebbles. Fruity Pebbles are gluten and casein free, and people think that that's a food, but it's not. Fruity Pebbles are really nothing more than paste with food coloring. I just want to tell you that we need to keep these foods full and whole, because remember, our goal is to not to do any more harm. It's to take the toxicity out, not add to the toxicity. And another part of this toxicity that's just so big out there right now is artificial sweeteners. And my biggest concern for the kids that are being given Splenda, because Splenda is nothing more than sugar that's been chlorinated or bleached, and it makes it so that it's basically it's a chlorinated powder, and happening is that it settles in the intestines, and we're seeing a lot of intestinal problems because of people who do a large amount of Splenda. And artificial coloring is another one. You know, it's made from coal tar, the same petrochemical that they put on our streets. It causes all kinds of liver stresses, really suppresses immunity. So we want to stay away from that. We want to stay away from nitrates and MSG. Nitrates are what keep meats pink. MSG are the flavor enhancers. Now, Mom sent one of the questions in that she went to, I think it was McDonald's or some fast food place, and they got this child a chicken breast, and no bun, and it was just grilled, and then it had just tomato and lettuce, and the child really reacted. My guess is, yes, it could be a cross-contamination. I'm not questioning that. But I'm not anywhere near as much convinced that it's cross-contamination as much as I'm convinced that it's MSG. Most fast food places will put large amounts of MSG on chicken because of the fact that chicken the chickens that they're using are so dead and so icky that they have to flavor enhance it. So the chicken makes a strong flavor enhancer. The child's probably reacting to MSG. Okay, another reason that foods can be a problem through this is alkalinity or acidity. And this has been made really big through Body Ecology Diet. She's done a lot to teach about alkalinity and acidity. And basically what it's saying is that a lot of these foods that these kids are eating, which are all carbs, and bad carbs, the simple carbs, as well as all the, even if they're, you're lucky enough that they're eating meats, those are all acid-forming foods. And it's the vegetables that bring us alkalinity. Now, just like a swimming pool or a hot tub, you need to keep it not too alkaline, not too acidic. But our kids are running acidic. Their blood is running acidic, not just their stomach acid. We're talking about their blood and their urine range are all running very acidic. And it's making, it's causing dysbiosis and a lot of other digestive issues. So it's so vital to be able to get those vegetables down. And we'll talk about how to do that. The last piece I want to say on different types of varieties of diets is that I really am a big fan of the blood type diet. Dr. Diadamo has written a few books. The latest one is Live Right for Your Type, and that's a great one to understand the difference in blood types. But the reason I find this really important is because A blood types, for example, do not have very good pancreases. They do not digest beef very well at all. They do great on lamb, they do great on fish, they do wonderful on chicken, but beef is not a strong suit. However, if you have an O who's not eating beef, they're going to be very lethargic, they're going to not feel very well because O's desperately need beef. So I do say, I'm not saying you need to do a blood type diet 100%, but it's worth just getting a little, get your nose into it a little bit, information on the different types of blood types out there. And then before we actually, I want to hit the piece of picky eating. Ernest, is it possible to take just like a 2-minute break really quick?
Sure, no problem.
All right, I will return in just actually it'll be just 1 minute. I'll be right back.
Okay, great. Hello, everybody. Hopefully, she'll be back here in about another minute. And so far, what do you think about what do you think about the information here? I'm going to unmute everybody and give me a second. What do you think about the information, everybody?
This is great. Phyllis.
Great.
Thanks for doing this.
No problem. No problem. Well, good. It seems like most of the people are actually listening online, so I will mute you again,
and we'll continue
when she returns here. Hold on.
I am back. I'm sorry. I needed to get some water, and I'm okay. Are we all set here? Okay.
Hello.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, I can. I just asked everybody if they're enjoying everything, and they said yes, so we're back again.
Oh, good. Good, good, good. I'm glad. It's always such a strange thing to talk to an audience that you can't see their faces or you don't know what's resonating and what's not resonating. I did doing radio for 3 years, and you just have no clue who's listening. It's kind of fun.
Oh, of course.
Okay, so let's get into the meat and potatoes of this, how to implement it, how to make this work in your household. So the first thing that I usually tell people is you need to start kind of setting these rules for what is it you're going to do. Now, when I say rules, the reason I say that is because when the rules come up front to the family, it's much easier than making them up as you go along because kids question everything. Now, I'm going to tell you that I have done this diet with a son that was severely sick and nonverbal and had no even understanding of rewards or things such as that. I have done this with a 7-year-old daughter who had Asperger's syndrome, who no longer has the diagnosis, but she perseverated to the extreme, and so I've done that with her. And I did this with a 5-year-old daughter who had unquestionably bipolar and severe ADHD. So I am not just talking about my son here. I've done this with all different types. And the reason I talk about the rules is because you need to kind of know what is allowed and what is not allowed, especially for the kids who understand this. I'll tell you what, a few parents talked to me about Asperger's, and Asperger's is one of the toughest to do this diet with. I feel a lot more sympathy for putting a child with Asperger's on the diet than a child with autism. Because a child is, and there's a huge difference between a child that's 2 and a child that's 12. It is never, ever too late to start this diet. I did not start this diet until I was in my 30s, and I did it for 5 years. I'm not on it. I don't really need to be on it as much anymore, although I still watch it carefully, but I'm not 100% any longer, but I was very strict for 5 years, and it helped me immensely to get through a lot of my digestive issues that I had to get through, along with many other things. So it's never, ever too late to start. But the reason Asperger's is so much harder is because here you're working so hard to get these children socially accepted. You're working so hard to get them to have friends and to get them to fit in, and now you're having to take something that's more quirky than anything else and give them different types of foods. So there's ways to make the food look more exciting and more like other kids' foods. We can touch on that a little bit today, but we're not going to have total time. I think it'd be funner down the road if we did like just a show on lunches or just one on, you know, breakfasts and dinners and things like that and kind of separate that. But for right now, please understand that that Asperger's is a challenge. So if the kids know, though, the rules, it will make it easier. Having special snacks for them, for example, when you if they're in a classroom and they frequently do birthdays where they have cupcakes, making your own cupcakes, some good cupcakes, and just having the teacher keep them in the freezer so that anytime somebody's bringing in cupcakes to school, you can take out one of their special cupcakes or the cookies or things such as that. Now, I've had one child who that was really important to, and another child who was so embarrassed by it that she would just rather not have it than to be different. So respect where the child is coming from, please, because it's so important. Try not to make a big deal for the children that are socially aware in front of their other classmates, but make a big deal for the kids that are not socially aware, because you want to make sure that the classroom is supporting the child. In other words, they're not pushing something on it. And I've had so many parents say to me that the classmates are so strict about what so-and-so can eat because they understand the importance. There's a wonderful book called No Cupcakes for Jason, and Stephanie Harlan wrote this book. I don't know. I'm assuming it's available through Amazon. We sell it on our website at pathwaysmed.com, but it's called No Cupcakes for Jason. It's a social storybook written for any child that is trying to understand, or the class is trying to understand why this child can't eat these particular foods. So the social part of it is a big piece. But you need to have those special type treats. And you need, only you can set what those treats are, because when people say to me, well, you know, just how healthy do I have to be? How much sugar is too much sugar? How much soda is too much soda? And I can never answer that, because it's what's working for your family. No, my family doesn't do soda. But if I go to the fair, I do let the kids get cotton candy. And, you know, it's like, but that's my choice. And it's not, it shouldn't be judged by anybody. It's not going to be judged by me if you decide that you want to do Skittles occasionally. It's what works for your family. So please don't feel like a failure if you can only do so much. I would much rather have you keep the diet 100% gluten and casein free and have some other foods that are in there that may not be so desiring than give up on this altogether, because we all can't do it all. We're dealing with enough as parents. So, but you want to try to have those special type foods that you can pull out, the kind of your bag of trick type foods. A lot of parents ask me about, they're doing ABA therapy and they need to have reinforcers. And this is becoming less and less out there. Most of the programs are not requiring food reinforcers as much as they used to, but if that's something that you are looking for, once again, there are so many different types of things, from grapes to specific crackers. You just don't want to be reinforcing constantly with a cookie, or with a chocolate chip, but you have to make the decision as to what's the motivation. So what I like to see is all of my families, this is where I say, you give them a very healthy breakfast, you allow some non-nutritional foods at lunchtime, and you give them a healthy dinner. The reason I say lunchtime be lenient is because of the social end of it. You know, I remember the first time my daughter brought a salad to school. She was in first grade, and she had a salad in her lunch, and she came back, and she was crying, and she said, "Salad is not allowed in first grade." And I said, "Well, why not?" She goes, "Because not one other kid had salad, and they all looked at me strange." And even though that was one of her favorite things to eat for lunch, it just wasn't working. And sadly, we kind of have to go with the status quo of all this because we need to make it easier for our kids. So if there's one meal that we're going to be lenient on, it's going to be lunch, but let's start them off good. Let's finish their day well. And what is starting off good? It's not through Gorilla Munch cereal. Starting off good is getting some protein, and it's wonderful if you can get a little something green into their breakfast as well, too. Even if it's just a handful of sprouts, it'll help raise their alkalinity. And please don't give up on me yet. We are going to really hit the picky eating part, but I just want to get through what ultimately I want you to be eating. The next part is I like for all meals, especially dinners, I want you to think of your meals in threes. It makes it much easier for parents because they say, well, I don't know how much of these foods are the appropriate amounts. But if you think of a triangle and a third of it being from protein and a third of it being from vegetables and a third of it being from something that they really like some sort of a potato or rice or some sort of a bread, and kind of always thinking of your meals in thirds that way, it'll make it easier for you to plan at the beginning of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to hit the picky eating because it's one of the biggest questions that people ask me, and it's such a frustrating piece. Now, earlier I was talking to you about, you know, how our kids really are starving when they're not getting nutrition. But when they say to me, but it's all they will eat. It's all they will eat. And please, no, I've been there. I've walked this walk. If they lived 100 years ago when there weren't Goldfish crackers and macaroni and cheese and the only food that was on the table were meats and vegetables and potatoes and things such as that, I guarantee they wouldn't starve. But we have introduced these foods and we have kind of ruined our children into, and by that I mean we're taught things from our pediatricians, things like giving our kids juice so they don't even learn to drink water. They don't even know, they learn from a young age that the only thing they should be drinking is something sweet. And they learn from their pediatricians the first foods you should be giving them are fruits, which is the opposite. They should be eating vegetables first because once they get the sweetness of fruits, they don't care for the vegetables. And it's these type crackers and the Cheerios and things that we're giving our babies that are making them very grain dependent. So we really have to take responsibility to the fact that we have created this in many different ways. I, along with all of you, so once again, not pointing any fingers, but we have kind of created this, so it's our really responsibility for taking them out of it. Now, it's very, very fair to say that, yes, but with autism, we've got texture sensitivities. Yes, that's exceptionally fair to say, and we're dealing with an even bigger situation than just the standard picky eating child that's out there, which doesn't, they're everywhere. They're most of the kids that are out there. And it's because texture sensitivities become very difficult. Now, how I like to explain this is, I went to Asia, I guess it was last year I was in Asia, and I learned while I was there that there are many cultures in many parts of Asia that eat worms. They actually eat them, they eat them live. And
wow.
Not all.
You're going to have to pass on that one.
Okay. Well, good, Ernest, because I'm going to have you do this little exercise with me here. Because think about this. Think about what would it take to get you to eat a worm. Now, if you knew that an entire culture, I mean a whole millions of people eat these every day, and obviously they're thriving on them. So just like your mom is saying to you, but everyone else eats them. So if you were living in an environment where they ate them all around, would you all of a sudden desire to eat them? Probably not, because it's not what you were raised on. But why would you be afraid of the worm? And as silly as that sounds, that's the mindset that you need to understand when understanding your child's picky eating. Because what they're terrified for usually isn't so much the taste as they are to the way that it's going to feel. So this is why you need to start small. Now, I know I have some picky eaters that are so extreme out there that they truly will eat nothing but a carb. So this is where we start. Usually I recommend meat, and then I do vegetables next. You do whatever you're comfortable with, but let's start with meat, because I've had so many patients over the years that they would not touch meat. And this is how we started off, or any type of a food that's new like this. We do what's kind of this ABA approach, which is a first this, then that. If your child does not understand the concept first this, then that, this does make it a little bit more of a challenge, but that's also attainable too, because my son didn't understand that command until he was much older, and we were able to work with him as well. But it works similar to this. You take something that the child really likes, like French fries, and you take a hamburger. You start exceptionally easy and very attainable. For example, maybe the first time you do this, you just simply have to get them agree to put the hamburger on their lips, and then you give them the reinforcer of the French fries. You cannot have the French fries in their reach, because you have to be in control of giving them the French fry as a reward. The request may be simply just touch it to your lip and you get a fry. Okay, then reward them in any way you want to from that point forward. But you want to start this very slow. The next time you may want to do, okay, now just put it in your mouth and then get the reward. The next time is when we start actually making them responsible for eating it. So you have to start, though, when you're doing this, minuscule, minuscule bites. I mean the tip of a pin type of thing, so small that it's very, very achievable. Think about that worm. What would it take to get you to eat a worm? If it were really, really tiny and you had your favorite food right next to it and they said, listen, you can dip it in ketchup. You can put it in your favorite food and disguise it that way, but let them feel the responsibility for it. I Jessica Seinfeld came out with that big book, Deceptively Delicious, and I like that in many different ways, although her recipes aren't healthy at all, but she uses a lot of like vegetable oil and just stuff that's not necessarily good. No mention of anything is much of organics and things such as that. But I love her. We've been doing this for years, sneaking in the vegetables. But I don't want to be deceptive, because I think the kids need to learn that you can eat this and it's not going to hurt you, because you cannot spend a lifetime disguising their vegetables. Teach them that they're not scary. Teach them that the meat's not scary, and get them to start breaking it down. So when you do this piece where you put it on their tongue, they swallow, they get their reward, then you just consistently make the bites a little bit larger, a little bit larger. Once they realize that this texture is familiar, it's comfortable, the taste is not scary, they'll be more willing to try bigger and bigger bites. And that's really kind of your beginning for this. The next piece that I say is very, very strongly is that you have got to be strong and really, just determined isn't enough, but just that you're adamant that this is what is going to happen, that you are going to eat this, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts. A typical story is, I say, okay, Betsy, I took all your advice, and I sat at the table, And the only food I had out there were the French, was the chips that he likes and the meat. And I said, you can't get the chips until you take this little teeny, teeny bite. And he screamed, and he left the table. And I say, okay, so then what'd you do? Well, I put it all away, just like you said. I didn't leave it out there, and he had no access to any other food. Great. Okay, great job. Now, then what happened? Well, then it was dinner time, and he came back, and he was really, really hungry. And he said, he was crying, and he wanted those chips so badly. So I said, okay, what'd you do? He says, well, I stood by what you said. I took out that little teeny piece of meat, and I said, you have to eat this first, then you get the chips. And he said no, and he screamed, and he walked away, ran away again. And, okay, excellent. So then what happened? Well, then it was time for bed. And, well, of course it was time for bed. I didn't want him to go to bed hungry, so I gave him the chips. Now, what is the moral of the story? The moral of the story is that you have now taught your child that if they hold out long enough and if they cry long enough, eventually they're going to get what they want. And this is not what you want to be teaching them, because then it's just going to make your job harder and harder. A child can go many days without food, not without water, but it can go many days without food. So eventually they'll eat something. And something, you know, even if all you're getting them to eat is maybe it's just a bite of even though it drives me nuts, Gorilla Munch cereal, whatever it might be, that's still at least a calorie that's going to keep them from starving themselves. So I'm just saying that you want them to really kind of hold out, you want to hold out as long as you possibly can to make sure that they get this nutrition in them. And then once they understand that you're serious, they know that it's from that point forward, your life just gets easier. Now, the other thing as I was talking to you earlier is about that triangle meal where you have your meat, your vegetable, and your, say, for your potato, for example. Now, this is where I recommend getting into a format. And this is great with young kids, but I've done this on older kids too. And if they really, really love that potato, mashed potatoes, for example, or that rice, they don't like the rest, then you don't do finish your meat and finish your vegetables, then you get the potato. You do bite for bite for bite. Bite of meat, bite of vegetable, reward, bite of potato. Bite of meat, bite of vegetable, reward, bite of potato. And you do things in these threes. And this, it gets them in a pattern of eating things in a way that they can, they're constantly getting that reinforcement for what they want. Now, parents will say to me, that sounds like a lot of work. That sounds very hard to be having to sit there. And I'm not disputing that. You do have to actually sit there when you get there. But once they get the format for that, they'll be fine. Now, I was saying earlier that I recommend doing equal amounts, one-third the vegetable and such. But when you first start this off, I don't recommend that you have to go that severe. I think that you can sorry, I just had to kill a moth in my room. So the whacking sound came from. When you first start this off, keeping these bites really small, really attainable, so that the first time you do this, you may have one teeny spear of broccoli. You may have the size of a quarter of a hamburger. And then you may have a big heaping plate of French fries. I am totally okay with that because of the fact that this is teaching them this whole trilogy of foods. And then gradually you start increasing the others. Now, I also live by the piece that not everybody has to like everything. I mean, maybe what you made really is awful. There's a lot of people who don't cook very well, and I probably would be picky towards the vegetable as well, too. So in those cases, you want to do, and remember I was talking earlier about those rules, setting those rules? Our rule when my kids were growing up was always the three-bite rule. Just three bites. If you don't like it after three bites, you don't have to eat anymore. And this way, they kind of the rule part makes it easier for them to be able to know what's expected of them instead of how much of this do I have to eat. Well, they know the rule. Okay? So the last part on this part that I want to hit is setting a good example. And this is something that really kind of amazes me because I have parents that say, I just don't understand. They won't eat any vegetables. But you know, I don't really blame them because I won't eat any vegetables either. Well, you know, kids are watching you. They're, even if they have a disability, they're watching you. They know what is normal on the table and what is not normal on the table. So you really have to be setting a good example for. I think it's downright cruel to be putting a child on a gluten casein free diet and then ordering a pizza in front of them. You need to do this as much as a family as possible. Sure. It usually benefits the whole family as well.
Wow, you know, I tell you, you've got so much information here. It's just, we got to have you back again.
Oh, well, thank you. Are we
so
done?
Much,
no, we still have more time, don't we?
Oh, no, no, we're not.
Okay,
we're not. We've got to have you back again.
Okay.
So I get all these people here are saying, hey, I want to ask my question.
Oh,
so,
I'm sorry.
Oh, no, no, not at all. You know, we want you to keep going.
Okay.
Well, maybe we'd like to bring you back. I could bring you back to do that because we've got about 45 minutes, not unless you want to, we can extend this a little bit here, but we've got a lot of questions from people, one of which, as you're talking, people are asking questions, and one question came in from,
okay.
Her name is Sandy Weller, and she's from Vancouver, Washington.
Great.
And she says, help, recipes. Does she have some or know where I can get them? Love your seminars. Thank you.
Okay, wonderful. My favorite gluten and casein-free recipe book out there is through an author called Susan Vess, S-U-E-S-O-N, and her last name is Vess, V-E-S-S. And her website is specialeats.com. Susan is is my closest girlfriend, and that's not why I'm recommending her book. I met her because I loved her book so much, and we ended up becoming very, very close friends. If you're on my website, pathwaysmed.com, you can purchase the book on our store, but you can also go directly through Susan. It's the same price regardless where you go. And Susan actually works as a diet counselor for my business, Pathways, and she does private diet counseling as well and would give you all the same information that I'm giving you today. That's a one good source. The other thing is I am really the worst person when it comes to recipes because I am kind of an innate cook in that I don't follow recipes.
I do the same thing.
It's my Italian heritage. I just somehow was blessed with knowing what to do. And I've come to respect and realize not everyone's like that. But I can't decorate my house to save my life, so we all have our fortes and our. I have to have my husband decorate because we all have our talents. So I'm not a good person because I'm just always like, well, you just add a little of this and that. But Special Eats is a great one. The kid friendly, I think it's called Kid Friendly Gluten and Casein Free Book by Dana Lake. I want to say is her name. I interviewed her on my radio show. Her book's pretty good. My frustration with so many of the gluten casein free books are that they're just downright not nutritious. I mean, yeah. I don't need another recipe for, you know, a cookie mix. I want to know how to make a meal. And Susan Vess's book, Special Eats, teaches you how to make a meal, not just another pancake or cookie recipe. Although she has good pancake and cookie recipes, that's not the meat and potatoes of her book. And So that's a good one there.
Got a couple more here. I got John from Salt Lake City, Utah. Essentially, he says, hey, I really want to try this, but, he's got six children.
Okay.
And how can he afford this? I mean, it's obviously, I mean, the milk thing certainly sounds like a good idea. Cashews, I guess, if you get the split kind, which is news to me, I did not know this. If I've learned anything from this, it's to get the chopped
cashew
up,
pieces. They're out there.
Because the other ones, the whole ones, are way too expensive and raw.
But
how can you afford it? Because obviously for some people this might be an issue.
It's very challenging, especially when people are on food stamps and things such as that, where the government loves to subsidize with what's their favorite food, cheese. So here are some tips, because I do believe that you can make all of this very affordable. Now, the person with six children, do you know where they live?
Yes, they live in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Okay. So the first thing you need to do, honestly, I am just such a believer in this. I live in truly the middle of nowhere, Wisconsin. Actually, it's not that bad. It's just a big farming community. Nobody knows this area. But believe it or not, Wisconsin is number one organic farms in the country. But the first thing you want to do is find an organic farmer by you. Now, I am so big with organic, and that's also a lecture for a whole other day, because you're getting so much more nutrition. In many cases, you're getting 70% more nutrition from organic beef, grass-fed organic beef, than you are from the meat that you're finding in the grocery store.
Yeah,
so if you're only getting a small, minuscule piece down your child, you want to make sure it's good piece of meat. So
sure.
Even if it's not organic, I'm sorry, what, Ernest?
Oh no! I was just gonna add to this, and I didn't mean to I'm sorry to interrupt
sure.
you, but I was just reading the other day that most of the beef we get is corn fed.
Yes,
and
terrible.
And if they take these cows and they just plop them full of corn over 145 days before they send them off, where before
sad.
Some 20, 30 years ago, we used to get all of our beef was grass fed because you know they were out there grazing.
Sure.
And that's all changed now.
Sure. Exactly.
Oh,
and you think of it, do you want a cow that's been eating Captain Crunch, or do you want a cow that's been eating a salad bar? If the nutrition doesn't go in the cow, the nutrition can't come out of the cow. So if your cow's not eating grass, then it's not getting a lot of nutrition. So here's what I recommend anyone to do is to bypass the grocery stores and go directly to the farmers. Now, I know in New York City that this is next to impossible. I know probably in Irvine or anything like that that's impossible also. But there's a lot of places in this country, especially if you're in Salt Lake, that you can travel not too far, you know, once every few months and buy a quarter of a cow or buy chickens on the days that they slaughter so that they don't have to even put them, you can bring them right down back to your freezer. I'm so big on this because people are buying pre-cut and packaged things that chickens are the perfect example. Chicken breasts and chicken these pieces are so ridiculously priced when we need to start buying whole chickens again and just cutting up our own chicken. It's not that hard to do. You get comfortable with it after a while, and you can use all the parts of that chicken. I take the chicken breast and I make chicken salads or chicken strips or things such as that. I take the thigh meat and I make nuggets from those types of things. I barbecue the wings or the drumsticks. I take the carcass of the chicken and I submerge it in a pot of water and make stock. I use every single part of that chicken. I take the liver of the chicken and give it to my pets. It's like we use everything, and that's where you save money, when you buy things in whole. Now, if you go to a farmer, even if you only have to take a 4-hour drive every 6 months, but you're buying enough to last you, you're saving usually 70% what you'd be paying in a grocery store. So that's one piece. The next piece is to concentrate a lot on beans and rice. And beans and rice are wonderful gluten casein free foods. You know, I was in Costa Rica years ago, and these kids were naturally eating a gluten casein free diet. They were eating beans and rice and the eggs that their chickens were laying, and of course it was a lot easier to get vegetables for them. But I mean, this is the world that they knew, and we have kind of worked our way into that's just not what we eat here, but it can be what we eat here. So beans and rice are a good one. Also, just not buying things pre-cut, not buying bagged lettuce or things such as that will save a tremendous amount as well.
Right.
Now, when it comes to the breads, here's my biggest recommendation for saving money. Get yourself a really good cookbook, but even there, you can go online for so many recipes. I mean, all you have to do is just Google gluten-free bread, no corn, something like that, whatever you want to do, and you won't believe all the things that will come up. But make your own flour blends. Remember I was to say at the very beginning that you've got your flours, but you need to have the right combination in order to make it work. Carol Fenster is one of the best when it comes to teaching people how to make flower blends. You could go to her website, Carol Fenster's savorypalette.com. Savorypalette.com is Carol Fenster. She's got some good books on making flower blends. And that saves a ton, because what I do is I have this huge, huge bowl, the biggest bowl that I own, and I quadruple my flower blend recipe, and I make these big batches and put them in these airtight containers, glass containers, and I just store them. And then whenever a recipe calls for anything, because it could be a wheat flour that it calls for, but my blend will substitute for the wheat flour. So I can just substitute my blend for what might be in any basic recipe. So you can take your same recipe books and use them interchangeably if you know what to substitute. You know, we talked about the cashew milk, or even if you're just having rice milk or whatever it might be, and substituting these things yourself. But where you're going to lose the money is buying all the packages, or the pre-made and the pre-packaged stuff.
Yeah, that's where everyone is so busy that, you know, they get the prepackaged to save the time, and not sure exactly what's in there.
Yeah, you have a lot more fun making your own flour blends, because you can throw in some nutrition. I mean, sometimes I'll put in a little extra, you know, almond flour. Maybe sometimes I'll use some coconut flour if I know I'm going to be making something like pancakes or something, just to give it some different types of flavors and nutrition.
Okay. Let's see here.
I have some questions, too, that you had brought to me earlier.
Why don't
sure
you
that
go through those, because those are what I, came in initially.
That I hit all of these.
There's actually one you could answer really quickly.
Okay, good.
Because I want to know the answer to this one. It's here's a question here from, I read contradictory information regarding McDonald's french fries. Are they not gluten-free?
Okay, so my favorite McDonald's french fry story is a patient of mine. Sorry, I can't answer this quickly. there's a story attached. But a patient of mine one time literally gave every single day of this child's life, went to McDonald's and ordered her child an extra large McDonald's french fry, and the child would eat the french fry. And that was a regimen of this child's diet for years, every single day. And the mom said to me one day, when this whole report came out, she said, I finally now understand why my daughter has been gaining so much weight. And I go, what?
Mm-hmm.
She goes, it's the gluten in the french fry.
Wow. So
I was like, you know, I hate to tell you this, but even if there is any gluten in there, and it is exceptionally minuscule, there's a lot more to those french fries than that minuscule amount of gluten. I'll tell you what, Ernest, I am not a stickler when it comes to, I'm a severe stickler with cross-contamination. I do think that there is a potential for there being a problem, and I definitely would agree that some children may react, but my guess is that if your child's reacting from McDonald's french fries, it's more likely to the junky soy oil that they're using and something called acrylamides, which is what happens when you take oils to extremely hot temperatures, much more so than the small trace amount of gluten that may potentially be in there. So are they safe? Safe is a very relative term. Are they gluten-free? I would probably say, as of this point, there's no conclusive evidence.
Okay.
Sorry. All right. I'm sure that was much more of an answer than you wanted to get. But that really segues into the question that I was asked a lot, which was what to do with overweight children and underweight children. And we kind of talked a little bit about that when they crave foods and they just constantly eat and eat and eat and eat because of the craving, when you take away the gluten and the casein, then it's very helpful that they won't necessarily be eating all the time anymore. But what I want you to really pay attention to when it comes to overweight and underweight is the types of fats that they're eating. Now, you need to understand, this is really important, our cells travel around our body in fat cells. That's how they move around. And if you get rid of all fat in your body, you are not going to be able to have very good cellular energy. It's going to be very hard for you to function and to move around properly. So fats play a really important role. But you also want to make sure that you're doing the right fats, because you don't want to be doing corn oils, soy oils, vegetable oils, all very, very junky oils that they tend to take to hydrogenated levels. You know, it cracks me up when Kentucky Fried Chicken does this great advertising that no more hydrogenated oils. Well, I've got news for you. Their oils may not start hydrogenated, but all they have to do is eat it through the first fry, and it becomes hydrogenated. So it's the oils that you want to be using. If you're cooking, you want to be using coconut oil, grapeseed oil, those specifically for more frying type things. And then
grapeseed at our house.
A great one. Olive oil, but you don't want to fry. You don't want to take it to much higher than 350 degrees. Palm oil is also another good one for frying. Most people know palm oil through spectrum shortening is palm oil. So that's another good one. Sunflower oil, safflower oil are all oils you can cook with. And my very, very favorite, and I'm a big fan of, is ghee. That's spelled G-H-E-E, and ghee is clarified butter. It's butter where the casein has been removed, and it's very, very good for your DNA. Your gene, it turns on good genes, great for digestion. And if your child does not have any IgG reactions to dairy, so you're just solely taking away dairy because of casein-related issues, then it's perfectly fine because there's no casein in it. Okay, and then non-heated oils, the oils that are great that you just don't want to heat them are extra virgin coconut oil. Coconut oil that heated is expeller pressed. Non-heated is extra virgin. Hemp seed oil you don't want to heat. Olive oil, good high quality olive oils you don't want to heat too high. Flaxseed oil definitely don't heat at all. Flaxseeds lose all of their omega-3s immediately after you've heated them. Walnut and almond oils you don't want to heat as well. And then, that's really where the key is to gaining weight and to losing weight, is just using the proper oils. And then, of course, introducing vegetables for those that are dealing with weight issues. Oh, and let me say this, too. The underweight children, frequently the kids that are underweight, their problem is low amino acids. So it's important, more than anything, for these kids to be getting ample amounts of protein.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, more questions?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, just throw them at me.
Okay, let's see here. How effective is the casein and gluten-free diet in a child who has high-functioning Asperger's? I think you hit on that briefly.
It's very effective. I mean, this is just, you know, anything that we're dealing with from anything, especially mood to, because if they're high functioning and they're operating perfectly well, this could help with perseveration. It can help with it can even help in social situations for being able to, neurotransmitters to really be able to work well. But especially with Asperger's, don't just look at the gluten casein. Look at the whole pictures of food, because when you're looking at neurotransmitter problems, remember, most people think, oh, all the neurotransmitters, they're in the brain. No, a lot of our neurotransmitters, the second greatest place for neurotransmitters is our gut. So what we eat affects how we think, how we process, and how we socially interact.
Okay, I've got another question here, and that is, let's see here. This is a question that I've heard too before. What they're asking is, her name is Michelle, and she's from Falcon, Colorado, and her question is, what is your take on delivery to your door-type companies? Because I know there are companies that actually deliver gluten-free and casein-free diets directly to your, or meals directly to your door.
Wow. I think if you've got the money, go for it. I have, in the wintertime, I have my vegetables and I have basically my vegetables delivered to my door. I buy all of my meats and things like that directly from the farmers, but my vegetables get delivered from a co-op type thing, and I do that just because it's very hard for me to get to a grocery store based on where I live. But the pre-made meals, I mean, you've got companies like AllergyGrocer.com, which is a great company. AllergyGrocer.com has a very large variety of different types of foods, but, you know, packaged foods, not like, are you speaking of like meals that you, that are frozen that getting delivered to the door? Or?
Yeah, actually, they as a matter of fact, I was just looking at something just the other day. I met them about 6 months ago, and they're out of California. I don't know the name, unfortunately. Maybe I can add that later, but they actually fix gluten-free meals, pre-made meals.
Wow,
and then they ship
great.
Them directly to you, which is kind of nice for those people that are on the road. Of course, it is expensive, of course.
Right, right.
Everything from shipping and the preparation,
I think,
I'm sure.
You know, it goes to that. If that's what fits your lifestyle, then go and then do that. But, you know, once again, I'm really for the family, being a family and sitting down at the dinner table together and eating the same thing together. And, you know, it's to me, it's a really important part of the family unit. So I like making sure that our family eats, you know, all the same. There's no reason for not all of us to eat the same.
Sure.
And Ernest, let me just say, because I think people are so stressed about meal times because they think they have to do so much, and it doesn't have to be that much. It's not that hard. You get a rice cooker to make your rice. You put potatoes in the oven until they're cooked. I don't use microwave for anything because microwaves destroy the nutrition that's already in your food. You know, you take a vegetable, you cut it up, you saute it with a little olive oil. You take a chicken breast and you put it in the oven when just sprinkle some seasonings in. This is a really big tip for those people who are buying foods like rices that are seasoned rices or buying things that are already marinated and things such as that. Go to a company like, of course, organic spices are great, but then there's companies like Penzeys, P-E-N-Z-E-Y-S, P-E-N-Z-E-Y-S .com, which is a spice company, and you can order poultry blend or sausage blend or whatever these things might be, and, you know, you just take your chicken, you put a good olive oil on top of it, sprinkle it with the poultry blend, and put it in the oven, and people... That it doesn't take very long to do things like that, but we're putting so much stress that we've got to create these elaborate meals. And I think our kids would enjoy it much more that if we eat whole foods rather than these big type casserole-y type things.
Right. Okay. The I have another question here. Let's see. Let me go through here. It's hard to find out some that you want to ask right away.
Sure.
Let's see. What are some of the this woman is Lisa Stutzman from Chesapeake, Virginia. And her question was, what are some of the behaviors of children who are gluten sensitive?
Okay. So we kind of talked about that a little bit at the beginning, which were some of the things that you would expect to see, I guess, is what she's asking, to know if they're a candidate for being on a gluten-free diet.
Right.
Or I'm not sure.
I think she was just asking what things that, in other words, what type of, how do people react when they have a gluten problem?
Okay. So there's different ways to look at this gluten problem. Because there's the opioid effect, which we talked about at the beginning. But then gluten in general is a problem for so many people, and that's usually a lot due to digestive issues. Gluten, especially if you've been diagnosed with any sort of digestive, like irritable bowel syndrome, any kind of a cramping, diarrhea, constipation, frequently those are big gluten problems. You can get tested for gluten intolerance, but the best test for that is just to do it and just to try to do it. Whereas dairy, people who have problems with dairy, aside from the opioid piece, once again, it's a lot of mucusy problems, a lot of allergies, asthma. Those are all big things that are indicator that you want to take dairy away. Red, brown, big circles, black circles under the eyes, another big dairy one, but it could be gluten as well.
Okay.
In general, they're not foods that you have to say that, oh, this is another good one, Ernest, because this was asked of me too, and this is, but how, you know, this is the big question, but if I take gluten and casein, they're going to be missing out on so much good nutrition. No, they're not. I mean, unless you were eating spelt bread all the time or some really, really good, you know, kamut or some kind of good full grain type of bread, they're missing out on very little because the genetically modified overprocessed grains are worthless in our diet. As far, you can get plenty of fiber from from other good grains and fruits and vegetables. As for the casein piece, people say ask all this all the time. They say, well, how are they going to get their calcium? But you have to understand, when a cow has a calf and that calf drinks its mother's milk and thrives, if you took that mother's milk and you pasteurized it and you heated it the way that we do our milk in the United States, you kill all of the enzymes, that are responsible for breaking it down in that calf's body. And the calf would not live very long or would become very, very sick if they had to rely on mother's milk that had been pasteurized or heated. And yet the cow has four stomachs. We have one. It makes it even harder for us to digest it because there's no enzymes left in our milk anymore. So what happens is we drink this milk and we don't assimilate it. We don't break it down. We don't have the enzymes to pull in the nutrition for it. So you could drink tons of milk and eat tons of cheese and still get osteoporosis very, very easily. The people that get osteoporosis, usually the problem was not that they weren't milk drinkers or cheese eaters. The problem is probably that they didn't eat enough vegetables, because the vegetables are the true way to get our minerals. The other piece is that soda, carbonated soda, through the way that they carbonate it, when you consume that, it actually leaches the minerals from your bones. So big soda drinkers are big with osteoporosis as well. So please don't put the blame on the fact that you're taking away dairy. Dairy supplements are really essential to most people in today's day and age, and finding the right supplement for calcium, is the way to go. I can't spend any time recommending supplements on this. However, I'm very specific about supplements, and if you on our website, pathwaysmed.com, at our store, you can see all the different supplements that we do recommend, because don't be taking Tums, people. Tums is not your version of calcium.
Okay, now, I have one question here, and that is, what type of how long does it take to actually feel a difference?
Good question. I'm glad somebody asked that.
It varies all over the place.
It does vary, but I'll tell you what, 2 weeks tends to be about the magic number for the majority of people. I have had one child that got substantially worse for 2 weeks and then, like, you know, just right on track got better. But I had one child that I didn't see any improvement for months. And then I had another child that literally got better the next day. So it really varies on the child, but please understand there could be a withdrawal period involved with this. So if they are really kind of just, you have to think about it in the withdrawal way, just like a drug addict would be withdrawing from any sort of a substance that their brain was addicted to. And they're going to beg and look in the garbage and do whatever they can to get their fix.
Mm-hmm.
So be prepared for that in many different cases, but it does get easier.
Great. Now, I tell you, I've got a great question here from Suzanne, who's in Iraq.
All right.
Yeah,
where it's now a quarter to six in the morning?
Yeah, something like that. It says, hi, this is an original question. I don't know if she's on the line or not. If you are, just post a message if you're listening online. Hi, I'm living in the Middle East. I want to ask, is there a test which can tell if my son who has autism needs to start with the diet or not?
So I did mention this before, and that's the one that's done by Genova, which is the one that I like. I like that much better than the Great Plains test. So you go to the website genova.com, G-E-N-O-V-A.com.
Okay. Very good. All right. And let's see here. We're going through a few. Well, here's a question from Chris from Camarillo. What is the best, almond or rice milk? Also, my son craves green vegetables. Is there a reason for it?
Okay, so the best almond or rice milk, good question, because the brands, boy, they're popping up all over the place. I like Pacific. I think Pacific is a good company. But let's see, I do a lot of hemp milk, which is my favorite. And I don't even
that's
know
what I drink.
Hemp Bliss, that's the one that I use right now. Those mm-hmm. are a really good ones. So your child craves green vegetables. Well, let me tell you, probably 99% of the parents listening today are exceptionally envious of you because that's a really, really cool thing. Now, there's a lot talked about with the oxalate diet. I am not an expert on the oxalate diet, which can be some of the situations with green vegetables, but for most all cases, I am going to recommend strongly that green vegetables are a good thing unless you're actually noticing a problem with them. One thing with green and green in general is the chlorophyll. Chlorophyll detoxifies, and sometimes, you know, they can naturally be craving that as a detoxification. My son takes green vegetation outside and rubs it into his hands, and I know it's because he's craving the chlorophyll in there. So that could be a very good thing, but it's something that you may want to potentially look into is the low oxalate diet, because they say that some children have a problem with things such as spinach that are high oxalates.
Mm-hmm.
But please, the reason I don't even like to mention that is because it's a very rare situation, and I do not want people going off of spinach because of the fears of oxalates. But there is a subset of foods that do frequently cause a problem, and those are called salicylates. And on my website under diet counseling, I think I have foods that are high, medium, and low in salicylates. But salicylates are natural preservatives found in foods, very high in things like honey and almonds. Berries are very high in salicylates. Cinnamon, a lot of spices are high in salicylates. And those foods are, salicylates are basically these natural preservatives that foods have to keep the food fresh within it. So it's not chemically, although you can get bad chemical-based salicylates, but it can be in really good food too. Kids with really, really dysfunctional detoxification systems where their livers just are not functioning well sometimes have problems with salicylates, and once you get their liver functioning back to normal, they do better. But in the meantime, that's something you may want to look into, are foods that are high, medium, and low in salicylates.
Okay. Great. I know I've got a question here, and I'm going to frame it here, do a little after question here, and that is, her name is Michelle, and from Colorado, I think she had a question before, and is, what is one item that is in most kids' diets that we can change to start with, or is there such an item, i.e. peanut butter or bread?
Okay, I want to make sure I'm understanding this question.
Yes,
so,
I need to make sure, too.
So I'm thinking what she might mean is... you know, if you've got to go off all the food, say, for example, they're eating nothing but gluten, casein, and you've got to get off of everything, what is something that still is a food that you could do? Because peanut butter in general, I mean, most peanut butters are gluten and dairy-free. You know, of course, I'm really anti-Skippy and Jif and things like that because of the fact that they're high fructose corn syrup and hydrogenated fats as well. So a natural peanut butter would be something I would prefer. But once again, you know, we're taking this in steps, and not everybody's in the right same steps. So if just regular peanut butter or whatever it might be is where you need to go right now, I respect and honor that. That's fine. But that is a very good example of a food like peanut butter that everyone has. Of course, French fries are the big one that's always talked about, is that how French fries are naturally in most cases, they're gluten and dairy free, especially if you're making them yourself, and a lot of chips and things such as that. I'm trying to think of other foods that are that she might be thinking of, that she's just trying to think of foods to kind of survive on during the every kid is different. I mean, I've got some kids who, you know, love the bananas, other kids that like grapes, whatever it might be.
Before you go on, there's something here. Apparently, someone's tried to look up Genova online, but apparently it's not coming up.
Okay.
Maybe we got the spelling. I think the spelling that they gave me was Genova.
Thank you for asking. Okay. Yeah, I would be really feel sad if I messed that one up for people. Let me, Genova. Okay, let's see what kind of comes up here. You can ask me while I'm looking this up. Used to be called Great Smokies. Diagnostic.
Sorry.
I apologize. It's GenovaDiagnostics.com. So it's GenovaDiagnostics.com. GenovaDiagnostics.
Okay.
Sorry about
Great.
That, everyone.
Okay. Yeah, no problem. I'm sure people here are probably going crazy looking for that thing. But, yeah, we had a couple people that responded with that. So, good thing. Good, thanks,
yeah.
Everybody.
Thank you.
Okay, let's see here. Here's a person that asks, is lactate the same as rice milk?
No. Lactose, which is what lactate is removing, is lactose. Lactose is the sugar component of milk, dairy, where casein is the protein component. So all they've done in lactate milk is they've removed the sugar, has just as much casein.
Okay.
Because doctors frequently like to say that the reason you can't break down dairy is because of the sugars, and that's exceptionally false. For most anybody who says they do better on lactate would do a lot better if they got rid of dairy altogether.
Okay. Let's see. We had one person here, just as a note here, Candace from Racine, Wisconsin, said just sees Dr. Greg Heinz, and I did not realize you were from Wisconsin. So
yes.
That's somebody. So
cool. Yeah, I'm real close by to you in Racine. Good. That's wonderful. Come visit us. That's great.
And let's see here. Here we go. I got Michelle from Long Beach.
Okay.
And says, my 10-year-old nonverbal son with autism is a very, very picky eater. His favorite thing is to eat cheese. What's a good substitute? Can you recommend a vitamin supplement, which I think you can't, should be taking? So,
once again, if you can go onto our website at pathwaysmed.com and under our store, which is Elementals, you'll be able to see supplements that we do typically recommend. But as far as a cheese substitute, I have to say when you're starting a gluten casein free diet, because the cheeses are not very comparable, I would recommend completely going cold turkey away from cheese for a couple of months before introducing the cheese substitutes. If there's something you really like and then you have to give it up for a couple months, the substitutes are going to taste much better after a couple months than if you went directly from what they love to a substitute the next day. So, and there aren't a lot of good cheese substitutes. I mean, there are some rice milk cheeses that are out there, make sure that there's no casein in them. And once again, I was talking to you, there's actually in California where you, I think she said, this is Long Beach, California. Is that what she said this was from?
That must be, yes.
Okay.
Long Beach, California.
There's lots of raw restaurants, and raw restaurants are wonderful for making raw cheeses, which are made from nuts.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be my biggest recommendation, is to find a raw restaurant. There's got to be a ton of them in Long Beach, and go there to buy your cheese.
Okay. Yes, to just have a note here, my wife likes this almond cheese.
Yeah, I don't know if the almond cheese has casein in it or not. Make sure you read the label to make sure, because I have to say, we just don't do the cheese substitutes. So I don't know if the almond cheese does or not.
Okay. Well, let's see here. Let me check some new questions that have come in. Let's see here. Let's see.
If you're looking at those, let me just mention, I'm going to be in Mount Vernon, Illinois in a couple of weeks giving I think it's a free lecture out there. It's St. Mary's Hospital. Go to my website for more information on that.
Okay.
I do travel quite a bit throughout the country, and so if you're in a city that you're really needing to have somebody come and speak about diet to, please send me an email, because I do travel a lot. I'm always happy to get a lecture in for a city that really is in desperate need of getting these types of lectures in.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ernest. I just thought I'd plug that in there.
Let's see here. Here's one woman that asked, Julie from Knoxville, Tennessee.
Okay.
What is your experience with older children on the diet?
Well, it's a lot harder to start an older child on the diet unless they're a child who really wants to cooperate. I mean, there's a difference between a celiac person who hurts every day of their life. Their cooperation level is going to be a lot more than, hey, we don't like your behavior, so we're putting you on this diet. So it's a very different type of dynamic. So I don't know what your dynamic part is, but it is very hard to put a teenager who is Asperger's or who really has a lot of social situations already to make them do it, because it's very hard unless they're with you all the time to make them do anything.
Sure.
So It has to be really an agreement. However, if it's an older child that's not exceptionally high functioning, where you're still able to control all of their meals, then you can still see fantastic results.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see here. I'm going to ask you something here, and that is, we're kind of running sort of out of time here, but I was wondering this. If you had to sort of name five things that people here could take away with, what would they be? Or just what could be the top three things that they should know about these diets and what to take away from this from this conference that we've had?
Okay. So one would be, it's got to be 100%. And cheating only hurts the child. Number two is, don't just think in terms of gluten and casein. Think in terms of nutrition. And number three would be, set a pace that's attainable for your family. Don't ever feel like a failure. If there's a problem, if it's not going well, figure out why it didn't work. Figure out what you could do differently next time. And please, by all means, do not give up. And I am going to keep going because I can think of more. Number four would be, it's not just about diet. There's a lot more that needs to be repaired, because it's like, you know, it's like telling somebody that who's celiac, well, all you have to do is give up gluten and you're better. No, celiac is an autoimmune disease, so you better fix your immune system. It's the same situation here. Diet is a piece. I have been doing and counseling families and helping people for over a decade, and I can tell you so strongly that there is no one-size-fits-all. There is nothing cookie-cutter about the way autism should ever be treated. It has to be customized specifically to the child. And I will give number five. And number five is, don't contribute to the harm. In other words, our kids have been hurt enough through, be it vaccines, through the environment, through poor diet. Try to, at this point, minimize anything further. And at least the body knows how to heal. The body knows what it needs. You give the body the tools that it needs, and it can be well.
Great, great. Those are great takeaways. You know, I really want to have you back again.
Well, cool.
Because there's just so many questions here. For example, one person asked, what is chelation therapy? I know that's come up a number of times. Maybe when you can come back, we can discuss that, if that's something
I would love to do that. Yeah, maybe we should have my husband back with me next time. We can do it together.
That's perfect. That's perfect.
Because we like to finish each other's sentences. And
well, great. We'd love to have you guys both back.
Yeah, he talks from the practitioner point of view, and I talk from the parent point of view. He's an actual pediatrician. So he's a lot of fun.
You know, we would love to have him because there's just so many questions that keep coming in, and unfortunately, you know, there's just not enough time to address them all. But we really do want to thank you for spending the time with us here.
No problem. It's been a pleasure to be with you. Thank you to everybody out there. Wherever you are, please let me know where you're at if you need me to come to the city, because we need to educate people out there. We need to let people understand that food is important because it's the most important thing that we do to our bodies every day.
Right.
So thank you, Ernest, very much.
You bet. No problem. And for those of people that are still on the line, if you would, I really would appreciate tell me what you thought about the event. I'm going to give you a number here that you can dial. Let's see here. Unfortunately, I don't have it in front of me here, but I'm going to email you guys out and give you a number that you can dial that can tell me exactly what you thought about it. Give me your feedback, because I'd love to get it so we can continue to do these. Thank you so very much, and have a good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.